This weekend with our Islam seminar, a lot of work has gone into this, a lot of advertising has gone into it, but there's still time to make sure your calendar is clear and to make sure you're spreading the word about the weekend we're having. I'll go ahead and tell you that tonight's lesson actually is sort of meant to help us prepare to prepare. And if that doesn't make any sense, come back tonight and you'll figure out what in the world I'm possibly talking about. But we're looking forward to a great weekend, and been in communication with Wassam back and forth for some time. This was actually on the calendar before I even moved here. It's been on the calendar for a long time, and but I've been emailing back and forth with him and so forth for the last several months, and he's excited, and I hope that we are excited and spreading the word and looking forward to the weekend. Don't forget that Friday and Saturday evening will be over at Tillman's Auditorium. Sunday morning we'll be in here, and if we overflow this, I guess we'll stay in the parking lot or something. We'll figure something out. But looking forward to a great weekend. I'm going to preach this morning on attendance in worship, but maybe not in a way you've ever heard it before. And I mentioned this to Lee, I'm actually following some advice I got one time from a member when I preached in Nashville. I just mentioned one time in a Sunday morning sermon, just, you know, that the importance of it, Hebrews 10:25, blah, blah, blah. And after the service, one of our older men came up to me and said, "I appreciate you talking about that this morning. And I really appreciate that you didn't preach on church attendance on Sunday night." He had a point. I've kind of filed that little piece of advice away. But sometimes when we talk about the subject, all we do is mention that the first part of Hebrews 10:25 talks about not neglecting to assemble together or not forsaking yourself, and we kind of move on. That's all we ever do is mention there's the clause, there's the phrase. Or sometimes we have a couple of tried and true illustrations that have been told 100,000 times that most people have heard, but we think maybe those illustrations will touch the heart. Maybe we tell the story of the man who wrote into the letter of the editor. And what he said was, "I've been going to church for 30 years. And in those 30 years, I've probably heard 3,000 sermons. And for the life of me, I can't tell you everything found in any of those 3,000 sermons. So I'm not sure why I need to keep going." And after some time, some people kept writing letters back in response. And one person kind of ended the argument by writing this letter to the editor in response. He said, "I've been married for 30 years. In those 30 years, my wife has cooked for me approximately 30,000 meals. And for the life of me, I can't remember the exact menu of any one of those meals. But every one of them helped me physically, and if I had not eaten them, I would be physically dead. In the same way, those sermons have helped you, sir, spiritually from dying." End of letters. Or, we sometimes tell the tried and true story of the preacher who went to visit a man who had been out of duty for a little while, and while he was talking, he noticed that there was a fireplace nearby, and the man just kept saying, "I don't need to be around those Christians. I can be faithful on my own." And the preacher, in his wisdom, just walked over to the fireplace with an implement and pulled out a coal, an ember, and let it cool and turn black, and then left. And we usually end that illustration by saying, "And the man got the point and was in church next Sunday morning. Because by himself, he couldn't keep burning." Now, I'm not downplaying those illustrations. I'm not downplaying the use of those. They're fine. They're helpful. And maybe they touch your heart in a certain way. But sometimes, that's all we ever do. We kind of mention there's a clause in Hebrews 10:25, and then we mention a couple of illustrations, and we move on. But what I want to do with you this morning is go back to Hebrews 10, not just that one clause. Because what I want to do this morning is notice that around that clause, where yes, the command is given to not neglect assembling ourselves together, there are some things that are found there that should help us to realize not just that we need to be here, not just that it's a command, but that help us realize what we do for each other in worship. Now, it needs to be said, and I'll say it now, and hopefully I'll remember to say it again at the end of our time, that worship is primarily about praising God. It is our praise, my praise to God. That's the primary. But God, in His love and His mercy for us, has so structured worship as to make it a community, a communal thing, where we come together, and since we are together, we gain something from it. But sometimes, some people think no one would ever even notice if I wasn't here. No one would even really care if I didn't show up. And I think if we look very carefully at Hebrews 10, especially verses 24 and 25, I think we'll notice some reasons why it is important for each of us to be here for each other. And I hope throughout this lesson what we will see is why it was important for them then. In other words, why was this written to those Christians in the first century? And then why is it important for us today? I'm going to go ahead and tell you before I begin, before I begin the points, that the three main points, kind of the bullet points of this lesson, came from a lesson that Brother Dan Winkler gave at Polishing the Pulpit this year. It's one of those things he kind of threw away as an outline, and I thought, that's a whole sermon. Some guys can do that. I'm like, I'm going to take that and make a whole sermon. So the three kind of skeletons are his, but the meat hopefully is not just mine. Hopefully it's from the Scriptures. But three things we do for each other when we come together and worship. Number one, when we come together to worship, we think down. Now that sounds like a very, very strange statement. But did you notice that Hebrews 10:25 begins by telling us to consider one another? The word that's translated consider there literally does mean to think down. That's what the word means, to think down. And you may look at that and say, well, that sounds almost cruel, because when we talk about looking down on someone, that's not a good thing. But we're not talking about looking down on someone. We're talking about thinking down. So what in the world does that mean? Now, some of you may have to go back further in your memory banks than others, and some, I maybe get ready to get some of the kids like some kind of jitters or something, but I want you to go back to middle school science class. Sorry, kids. Okay, and I want you to remember the day when you finally got to use the microscopes. I looked for. I wasn't a big science person. I made decent grades, but I just didn't like it. But the day you got these microscopes was cool. I'm an introvert. You had your own microscope. That's kind of why I liked it. You know, nobody could kind of bother you. You got to look in your own microscope. But anyway, but you put the slide under there, and you have something on the slide. Maybe it's a hair, or maybe it's, you know, a couple drops of pond scum or pond water, you know. And you're supposed to kind of adjust the knobs and look down in there and see what all is going on. If it's a hair, maybe you try to find the cells. You're supposed to write a report or draw a picture of what you see. Or if it's a pond water, you're supposed to try to figure out what all was in that. Why is this moving and what's over there? What in the world are you doing? You're doing this. You are looking down and considering what is in that slide, what is in that you're looking at. Now, I don't think the Hebrews writer exactly had microscopes in mind, but the concept is exactly what he is talking about. Because the reason it's translated for us in so many translations as consider is because what he is telling us to do is to look at one another and think about that person, to really think down, look into that person's soul, look into their eyes, and to really think about what's going on in their life. How are they really doing in their faith? And I want you to put yourself for a moment in the shoes of those in the first century. Because you and I have an advantage over them in a lot of ways. One of which, of course, is all throughout the week we can check on each other. We can call, or we can visit, or we can text, or we can Facebook, or we can do all kinds of stuff to see what's going on in someone's life. We heard someone was sick, and so we can send them a text message, or we can email them or something and call them and see what's going on. Or we hear someone struggling with some temptation, we can just drive over to their house. That's not a problem whatsoever. They couldn't do that. At least not most of that. You think about the culture in which they lived, they didn't just text each other during the week. It didn't exist. And considering the fact that they didn't have the types of transportation and things that we have, they couldn't just drop in on people all the time just to visit. They might do it sometimes because you have the church meeting from house to house, but they couldn't just drop in whenever they wanted to all the time. We have that advantage. What's my point? My point is they had to see one another when they came together face to face to really think down, to really consider each other. And sometimes, because of the advantages that we have, we forget to do the same thing when we come together. Because I know this week I can text that person, or I can, you know, I can run by the hospital and visit their loved one who's in the hospital, or I can send an email, or I can make a phone call, and I can forget to really stop for a second and look someone in the eyes and say, how are you really doing? When we come together for worship, one of the great advantages we have is that we can think down. We can really look into each other's eyes and ask physically and hopefully spiritually, how are you really doing? We think down. But we also come together, not just to think down, we come together to stir up. What are we to consider? What is it we're to think down about? Consider how to encourage one another. Or to stir one another up. To provoke one another, the King James Version has. Now, the word provoke usually has kind of a negative connotation in our culture. Neil Lightfoot, and I like saying this, one of his commentaries on Hebrews, he wrote two. Some people just are overachievers. But in one of his commentaries on Hebrews, says that if you want to think about it this way, the word that's translated as stir up or provoke, he said maybe the best word for it is incite. He says that's probably the best concept for the word behind it. And the reason he says that is there's no way to think about a word like incite and realize it's not a very, very strong word. I had only seen the word paroxysm a few times while I was putting this lesson together. I kind of had to look up what it meant. That's the Greek word here, by the way. If you've ever seen that word, it's someone who's caught up like in a seizure or someone who's been gripped by a disease and their body tenses up really strong. And then I was putting this together, and like two or three days later, I know I'm a nerd. I was reading the biography of Millward Fillmore, definition of nerd, okay? And right at the end of the book, right before he died, the author said he was seized by a paroxysm. I was like, see, when you study the Bible, it helps you in all kinds of other places. But that's the word, actual word, that the Hebrews writer uses. And that sounds like a negative thing, to be seized up with something or provoked to something. But the reason the Hebrews writer would use such a strong, strong word is because he is trying to point out this is not something you can passively do. When you stir one another up, when you provoke or incite one another, it takes effort. But the what that we are to stir up is really what gives this its power. Because he says we're to stir one another up to love and good works. It may sound strange to see in Scripture that we are to stir one another up to love. The Greek word here is the word agape. That love that's self-sacrificial. That love that's others-centered. I like to think of it this way. It's the love that always seeks the ultimate best for the other person. Why would you have to stir that up in somebody else? Because it's not natural. And it's for sure not easy. And again, put yourself in their shoes for a moment. In the book of Hebrews itself, you've got to talk about Christians who have had their property plundered, Christians who have faced prison for being faithful, and all these things. Do you really think it was easy for them to have agape love for just their fellow man? Of course not. Look at what they're facing for being faithful. But then they come together. And a fellow Christian looks at them and honestly says, I love you. And you can go out and keep loving those around you. It stirs up, provokes something inside of them that says, this isn't natural and this isn't easy, but I can do this. And you think about those who were there, who were looking at a world around them where maybe they were the only Christian in their family and maybe their own family hated the fact that they were a Christian. Or maybe all the people they went to the marketplace with hated the fact that they were a Christian. And it's the book of Hebrews. So maybe some of their former Jewish religious friends hated the fact that they had now named Christ as their Savior. And now they're facing that seemingly difficult time. And they're persecuting them, they're threatening them, they're tempting them with different things. But a Christian says, you can do this. And that person has something inside of them that says, I can love my physical family. Even if they don't like what I am as a Christian. I can love those people in the marketplace. I can do what Jesus said and love my enemies. And I can love the lost. It stirred up within them because somebody took the time to say something. And then they're stirred up to good works, which translates exactly what it sounds like. Good works. You could translate it beautiful works. But again, put yourself in their shoes for a moment. How in the world do I keep doing what's right? Do I keep doing what's good when doing what's good seems to be what's getting me in trouble with people? People don't like it. People don't like that I keep talking about Christ. People don't like it that I really do have strong morals and try to stand on those morals that condemn the world, not even by what I say, but just by the actions that I take or the actions I will not take. Sometimes, when we come together, we need to be told by a fellow Christian, you can keep going. You can stand up for what's right. You can keep running that business in an ethical way. You can be the student at school who keeps doing what's right. You can do that. And yeah, I could text that to somebody. And yeah, I could email that to somebody. And I could call somebody and tell them that. But it makes a world of difference to look at someone in the eyes and hear them say, you can do this. You see, we come together for worship. A sermon might sort of incite something within us, and hopefully it does. Please, if it doesn't, please don't tell me. We can sing a song that might encourage us to love one another, and they should. We can sing songs that, you know, to the work, and it incites within us, you know, that we can do this. We might hear words such as we did this morning before we eat the Lord's Supper that might incite within us, you know, a love for Christ and even a love for our fellow man because of what Christ did. All of that's part of it. But God so structured worship that you and I can look at one another, and because we are together, we can incite one another, we can provoke one another, we can stir up within one another a love that's unnatural and not easy, and the ability to keep going on. We think down, we stir up, and number three, we call alongside. We call alongside. After the command in verse 25, not neglecting to meet together, the writer then gives sort of the opposite. Because this is the part we often forget. We focus on the first part of the verse, don't forget to meet together. But then he gives the opposite, the positive side of it. But encouraging one another. And all the more as you see the day drawing near. Now, I'm not sure which day he's talking about. Some people say it's the fall of Jerusalem. Some say it's the end of the world. For our thoughts this morning, doesn't really make any difference. The key is when he talks about to encourage one another. The King James Version has exhorting one another. This is the same word, by the way, that Jesus Himself used in John chapter 14, John chapter 15, and John chapter 16 when He promised to the apostles, I will send you another helper or another comforter. This is that word. What was He promising there? The Holy Spirit. But notice what He called Him. A helper, a comforter. Elsewhere in the New Testament, the same word is translated with things like beseech. But the word literally means to call alongside of. What's the point? The point is, you come together as Christians and you have other people who are walking the same way you are, who are facing at least similar, if not the same, trials as you are, and difficulties as you are, and temptations as you are, and you are able to call them alongside of you to walk this together, even when you go to two different marketplaces on Monday morning. Or in our culture, two different factories or two different offices, because you've been with them. Put yourself in the shoes again of those in the first century. And I want you to picture this in your mind as best you can. And it's difficult for us because here we drove here and we're in a nice room with fairly comfortable chairs and we're here on a Sunday morning in nice clothes and all of that. But I want you to put yourself in their shoes for a moment. Maybe you came to services last Sunday in the first century, maybe in a large city, Jerusalem, Rome, Alexandria. And all throughout the week, you've gone to the marketplace or wherever it is that you work during the week. Maybe you've gone out to your farm and worked and brought some produce in during the week to sell it. And you haven't really seen Christians at all. But last Sunday when you were together, Bobby, we were talking, and Bobby said, you know, this didn't really happen. This is an example, illustration. Bobby said, you know, I'm thinking about giving all this up. Because when I bring my produce into the marketplace and they know I'm a Christian, they won't shop at my market. They go right next door, right to the next cart, and I'm not sure it's worth it. Well, right there in the book of Hebrews, you've got specific examples where you talk about Christians who have faced prison, who have faced the plundering of their property. And you know those people. You know, you talked to them last Sunday. I know they came out to your house and they plundered your stuff. And I'm not sure I can keep going. And you show up on the next Sunday, whatever time of day it is. I don't know when they met on Sunday. Probably in the evening, most likely. But whatever it was, and there's Seth Bobby. He made it one more week. And there sat the person who had their property plundered. And there sat the person who was threatened with prison. And if they can keep going, can I not call them alongside of me for me to keep going? And we have that now. Sometimes you see them walking in with a cane or a walker, or someone has to push them in a wheelchair. And you wonder, why would you keep going when physically it is so difficult? And yet there they are. Or you talk to that young person who's being so made fun of at school. It's awful for them. And every time they raise their hand to answer a question in science class, oh, there's the Christian. There they are. And there they are. And there's the businessman who's thought about giving up because it's so difficult to run ethical business in that type of world in which he finds himself. But there he sits. And there's the person who's the only Christian in their house. And every time they leave the house, it's not that the spouse or the parents, it's not that they just make fun of them, but they're not going to support them. They're not going to make sure they get up on time. They're not going to make sure their clothes are laid out. None of that's going to happen. They're just going to, you go do your church thing. I'll see you at lunch. There they are. And when I face difficulty, guess who I want walking right beside me? The one who knows what it's like to face the same difficulty. That's who I want to call alongside of me and keep going. But I can't do that if I'm never around them. When we come together for worship, our primary responsibility is to worship God, to praise Him. And yes, there's a command there. We're going to get to that in just a second, but there it is. But God has so structured worship that we gain from it. When you and I come together and truly interact with one another and truly try to look each other in the eyes and say, how are things going? Then yes, we think down. We consider one another. Yes, we stir up. We incite love and good works in one another. And yes, we encourage, exhort, we call alongside one another so that we can keep going. What's the solution? The solution is the part of the verse that we almost always only spend our time on. Not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some. Is that a command? Yes. But you look at what it's couched in, and it's so much more than a command. Because what the Hebrews writer is trying to tell those Christians is not just show up and check off your list, I went to church on Sunday. No. What he's trying to tell them is look at what you're missing if you don't. You're missing people who are considering you. You're missing people that are going to stir up within you love and good works. And you are missing people that you can call alongside of you. Oh, and by the way, there's probably somebody looking at you that would like to be called alongside. If you think about that phrase then, that command, in the context, there are two realizations we have to make, and then the lesson is yours. When it comes to attendance, realization number one is, I have to realize that failure to attend is uncaring. And that may sound like a very strong word. It may seem that way. But when the Hebrews writer said, not forsaking or neglecting, some translations have, the English Standard Version has. The word that he used there is actually a word that means to desert. To desert. That's kind of strong language, isn't it? But think about it for a moment. What is he saying in the context that I am deserting? Oh, it's worship. Yeah, no. What have we just spent the last 20-something minutes talking about? What he's saying is when I neglect. Now keep that in mind. He's not talking about if you have the flu, please stay home. Okay? He's not talking about when we're sick. He's not talking about if my job changed my shift and there's nothing I can do about it. He's not talking about that. But when I neglect, when I forsake, what's he saying? He's saying what I'm telling you is I don't care about you. That's what I'm saying. Because I don't want to consider you. I don't want to provoke you to love and good works. And I don't want to encourage you. And I don't want to be encouraged by you. That's why he uses such a strong word as one that means to desert. I am leaving you in the difficult situation in which you find yourself so that I can just go my own way. It's uncaring. But then we also have to realize that it is a habit. As is the manner of some, as is the habit of some. If your translation has, as is the custom of some, that's it. Because the Greek word is actually the word ethos, the customary manner of life. That's what the word it means. As is the custom of some. You ever talk to somebody, I have over the years, I know you have as well, who used to come, they don't anymore. How does the story always start? Well, you know, one time we just went on vacation and we just decided not to go that Sunday. We got home, we were tired, it was just easy to sleep in. After 4 or 5 weeks of that, isn't that where it always starts? As is the habit, custom. You know the thing about habits? They can be broken. You know the thing about bad habits? They need to be broken. You know the thing about sinful habits? They must be broken. And yes, it's there because it's a command. But God has so structured worship that when that habit is broken and when the custom of life becomes, I am coming together to worship God primarily, but also to consider you, to stir you up, and to encourage you. Look at what I gain from that. I gain being considered. I gain being stirred up. And I gain being encouraged. It's not all that easy to preach on church attendance because somebody thinks, our numbers have been good lately. And they have. Great. I'm not preaching this as I think, oh, we just fill the room and add more. That's not it. But there are some cracks along the way. And the best time to preach about a problem is before it starts. I want us to always make certain that whenever our elders deem it is time for the church to come together, that we realize that if I neglect doing that, what I'm essentially saying is I really don't care about you. And ultimately, I really don't care about my soul. And so, yeah, I'll see you at 6 o'clock tonight. See you next Sunday morning. But far, far above that, my prayer is I'll see you in heaven. Because that's what this is all about. The ultimate one who considered us was Jesus. The ultimate one who stirs us up to love and good works is Jesus. And the ultimate one who encourages is Jesus. So it's no wonder that's what He would have us gain when we don't neglect to meet together. How are your habits? If they need to be changed, if they must be changed, will you come? Will you stand and sing?